Good morning, everyone. Welcome back. It is the morning of August 3rd, 2013. It's about 4:45 in the morning. A very cold morning here in Winnipeg. It seems like our fall weather is coming on about a month early. I hope all is well with you, wherever you are in the world. I don't really know what's going on for you. It's been the month from hell for me, but on a number of fronts, life is presenting things that are quite unpleasant. But it'll shift up at some point. I want to thank everyone who has written in over the past month, those of you who have sent in questions, those of you who have sent in words of appreciation, those of you who have sent in donations, and as always, I want to thank Marcus Fellows for establishing this website in the first place and for posting these talks each month. I'll be flying off to England on the 28th of this month to spend 2 weeks, some of which will be offering this non-dual presentation. In one situation, it'll be a 5-day retreat in the countryside, and in another situation, it will be a weekend in London. I will be away from August 28th to September 11th, so there won't be a talk, a response at the end of August. The next response will be at the end of September. But we've had some interesting things come in this month, so I'll do my best to pack this response with a lot of stuff. Hopefully it'll satisfy everyone for 2 months. So let's get down to it. A first person has written in saying, "Daryl, I recently came across your writings and have enjoyed them very much for their clarity and simplicity. Perhaps you have answered this question elsewhere, but can you explain how it is that the mind, a manifestation of this unexplainable, mysterious, continuously changing event, which we call universe, has as its inherent tendency, as all other manifestations have their inherent tendencies, the tendency or inclination to explain the unexplainable, or rather taking that which is inherently formless and like a potter with clay, molding it into form via thoughts, which you yourself have done in explaining all that is unexplainable? Or another way of putting it, how can that which is inherently illusion or formless itself, the mind, yours or mine, arrive at the conclusion of an obviously formless nature of the universe? Or how does illusion look out at an illusion and conclude that it's an illusion? I know that these questions have been around for a long time and, of course, involve another attempt by the mind, which is circling itself, as Krishnamurti used to say, to leave its cul-de-sac. However, what do you say? It seems to me that the universe, whatever it is, manifests what we call thought via mind, which in turn acts as a mirror reflecting back or commenting upon its origin, in an attempt to put that which is formless into form. This in turn, because of the projective nature of the mind, creates a universe that we might liken to a Rorschach test, in which we see what we want to see, resulting in multiple interpretations of the universe, all logical from the vantage point of the observer. In other words, yours makes sense to you, the Christian to hers, the Muslim to his, the non-dualist to hers, the atheists to his, and so on, do we not see what we want to see, which is more of a comment on the mind and the projective process inherent in the nature of its origin, universe, God, or whatever, than it is upon the formless it is commenting on? Okay, so I would just like to say no to pretty much all of that. But we'll go through it, through some of these points. He's basically asking if I can explain how it is that the mind, the manifestation of this unexplainable, mysterious, continuously changing event, which we call universe, has as its inherent tendency, the tendency to explain the unexplainable. And no, I can't. And non-duality can't either. What is classically known as non-duality can't explain it either. As the Ashtavakra Gita pointed out 2,800 years ago, the knower, the knowing, and everything known, these do not exist. What exists is, well, they don't even posit something as existing. They basically say there's just a happening that can't be explained in any way whatsoever. And that's not trying to explain that there actually is a happening. It's just saying that if the sense that life, the happening of this moment, is totally unexplainable arises, if that becomes the most obvious thing about this moment, that it is absolutely unexplainable, it still doesn't get rid of the fact that something seems to be happening. And so they'll say you're just left with what is. They don't go any further to say that anything about this what is, and they don't say that there isn't anything. They're just left with the conundrum that something seems to be happening in this moment, but there's absolutely no way of saying anything about it, and it's all happening automatically. So this person is asking me what my explanation for this would be, and I don't have any explanation for this. I don't need an explanation for this. The sense that all of this is totally unexplainable, that there is no tool for explaining any of this, that doesn't leave me with any urge to explain this in any way. Now, there are all kinds of descriptions that still seem to arise, and on a day-to-day basis, I can have a conversation with somebody about cities and houses and lifestyles and movies and all the rest of it, but essentially, I have no belief in any of those explanations, and I don't really know what's going on here. Even those discussions are a totally mysterious happening to me. But the great thing about this totally mysterious happening is that it all happens automatically. It doesn't really need me to believe any explanation. It doesn't even need me to have a particular explanation most of the time. I mean, if I'm confronted by somebody who's asking me what my particular view is of something, I'll present my view, but that view is ultimately useless. I mean, it may seem useful in a particular situation. It may seem to make sense to a bunch of people, but it's not really explaining what's going on in this moment. You're free to have, from a non-dual sensibility, and I've always said that this non-dual sensibility is not the one and only true way of looking at existence. Because even within the non-dual sensibility, it says there isn't any non-dual sensibility. That what's going on here is totally unexplainable. And it also has to acknowledge that this apparent non-dual sensibility isn't the one and only true expression of existence. It's just one of the many mysterious happenings of existence. Nobody gets to decide to have a non-dual sensibility. It's just one of the mysterious expressions of life. Like, you have no two snowflakes are the same. You don't actually have any two human beings with exactly the same sense of existence. Even if you look very closely at the world of form and stay within the world of form, if you examine it in great detail, you discover that there are no two people who have an identical sense of existence. In the same way that there are no two identical snowflakes, there are no two people who have the same skin composition, there are no two people who have the same breath rate, there are no two people who have the same pulse rate. There are no two identical people. And I have no explanation for that. I have no way of explaining why that is in the world of apparent form. It just is in this world of apparent form. And it's also the case that this world of apparent form is formless. Because all of us walk around saying everything is changing. We don't know why everything is changing. It just is changing within this world of apparent form. And then if we start to look at our thoughts about change, we begin to play all kinds of weird little games about, oh, well, if it's always changing, then it isn't really changing. Then it must be something that's staying constantly the same. And this is all just gibberish. But it's all appropriate gibberish. It's all legitimate gibberish. Because it's just a totally mysterious event doing what it does. We're not doing it. So for this person, it seems as though the universe manifests what we call thought via the mind, which in turn acts as a mirror, reflecting back or commenting upon its origin in an attempt to put that which is formless into form. This in turn, because of the projective nature of the mind, creates a universe that we might liken to a Rorschach test, in which we see what we want to see, resulting in multiple interpretations of the universe, all logical from the vantage point of the observer. So he asks me, do we not see what we want to see, which is more of a comment on the mind and the projective process inherent in the nature of its origin than it is upon the formless it is commenting on? And from my sensibility and from a non-dual sensibility, no, that's not what's happening here. That's an interesting interpretation. It's one of the valid expressions of this great mysterious event, but it is just a mysterious happening. There really isn't thought. In this moment, there's a happening that gets labeled thought, But in our examination of our storylines, if we look at the basic storyline that we all have a storyline that at one time we were a baby that came out of the womb and we didn't have any storylines. And in our general storyline, the storyline that pretty much every one of us carries, the story is that we were taught to say certain sounds by other people. So initially, coming out of the womb, our story is that there wasn't any story. And that is our story for every human being. So no human being came out of the womb with a storyline. And every human being's story is that they were taught to say certain sounds when certain forms were pointed to. Now that's true in our storylines for everyone. So there isn't anyone who arrived or after this happening of existence when it first presents itself. For every apparent person, there isn't any storyline whatsoever. And if we look at the storylines that we were given, if we look at the sounds, the labels that we were given, they're just sound. They have no meaning until they're attached, apparently attached, to a particular form. However, every one of us says that all the forms in existence are changing at some point. If we apparently live life to a certain degree, we discover that these forms, it seems more true to say that these forms are always changing. Doesn't matter whether you're a scientist or a plumber. When we examine existence, we find that all the forms in life are changing. Everything seems to be changing. So that the forms can't actually be the ultimate reality. The ultimate happening, the actuality, seems to be that whatever this is, it has form. And I'm not talking about, or it has no form. And I'm not talking about some weird thing that's existing apart from what's happening now. I'm saying if we look at everything around us and everything in us, all these forms that we seem to identify, we ultimately have to come to say that they don't seem to have any form at all because they're all changing. Or they don't actually have any form at all because they're all changing. So we have sounds, just any sound. Like instead of saying wall and floor and mind and consciousness, and we could say blix and flute and wazzle and dweezil, and they're just sounds. And they point to forms that don't actually exist according to our group experience. These forms can't ultimately be existing. So these meaningless sounds pointing to forms that don't ultimately exist don't really explain anything at all. And in fact, so what's happening here is just the contradiction of thought is presenting itself. Now, that's not leaving us with any ultimate statement about what's going on here. It's just saying that these explanations cannot really be an explanation of what's going on here. End of story, or not really end of apparent story, it's the end of belief in these stories. The end of any urge to explain existence, because it can't be explained. Now, that doesn't mean the apparent storyline stops arising, because we never made it happen in the first place. It's all simply arising on its own, moving and shifting on its own. But if we examine these major contradictions within our usual storylines, we discover that none of the storylines can be an actual description of what's going on here. So even this very detailed description of a formless universe that gives rise to a mind that creates thoughts, and a mind that is somehow giving a mirrored reflection of what's going on here, this storyline is just as ridiculous as any other storyline. Now, again, this is only from a non-dual sensibility, and I've said all along that a non-dual sensibility is not the one true way of looking at life. It's not the one and only way of apparently looking at life. It's not the one and only expression of whatever this happening is. It's just seems to be one of the mysterious, one of the infinitely mysterious expressions of existence. And what I'm presenting here is only what is generally known as a non-dual perspective. I have no interest in any of the other perspectives, because this non-dual perspective, this non-dual sensibility, is the only way that I'm expressed. Now, I'm passing no judgment on any other expression. I'm passing no judgment on any other view of existence. I'm simply offering what's known, or what's generally known, as a non-dual sensibility. It's not the one and only sensibility. It's not the one and only apparent sensibility. There are an infinite number of sensibilities within this world of apparent form. But ultimately, so what? None of them apply. As the Buddha said, descriptions do not apply. And it just means descriptions ultimately do not apply. And on our day-to-day basis, in our day-to-day living, these apparent descriptions come up. They move around, they shift around, they seem to be people sharing opinions, sharing descriptions of existence, but that explanation isn't really a true explanation of what's going on here. Meaningless sounds pointing to forms that don't actually exist do not explain anything. Even if they are helpful, even if they are seemingly helpful in a situation where we're thirsty and we need to ask for a glass of water, or we're lost and we need to ask for directions, these labels and storylines and descriptions are within their own world of description. They have to ultimately say that they can't be a true description. But that doesn't leave us with another description. It simply ends the possibility, it ends the belief that we can possibly describe life in any true way. And what we're left with is just this happening which goes on happening. Even if we sit and make no effort at all, the process that we are apparently continues, the happening of the moment apparently continues. There's no possible way of saying what any of it is, but it all happens anyway. Because it's just happening on its own. And those apparent storylines, our apparent opinions, will continue to present themselves in whatever way they present themselves. And all of that is a totally unexplainable eventing that no one is causing to happen. Again, this is from a non-dual sensibility, and I don't really even know what that is. You know, this monthly response, I don't know what this is. It just happens the way it happens. So, once again, as the Ashtavakra Gita pointed out, apparently so long ago, It stated, and I'll quote, "The knower, the knowing, and everything known, these three do not exist. You are the reality in which they appear. There is no cure for this false appearance other than seeing it as unreal. Objects being insubstantial," that means since objects are always changing, "do not exist. They are an appearance, like a snake in a rope." And Ashtavakra says, "I am like the ocean, and the many objects are like the waves. In the formless ocean, the world appears to drift here and there." Now, the formless ocean is everything that we see. Why is it a formless ocean? Because we walk around saying everything is changing. However, the world of form appears to drift here and there. And Ashtavakra says, "Whether things of the world appear to arise and fade away is not important. My true nature is not contained in objects, nor does any object exist in it, for it is infinite," and infinite means without form, without boundary. "Recognizing that in reality no action is ever committed, I live with whatever doing is presenting itself." So, once again, this non-dual sensibility is not attempting to describe what's going on here. So, in this person's question, he's asking me for my explanation of existence, and I don't have an explanation for existence. I have conceptual, what seem to be conceptual formats that I find useful for dealing with day-to-day life, but I don't actually have an explanation of existence. Now he asks, "Do we not see what we want to see?" In my experience, I don't see what I want to see. I basically see what I have to see. I didn't ask for this particular sensibility. I didn't ask for the sense that life is unexplainable. So no, I'm not seeing what I want to see. In fact, there have been a lot of situations in life where my life would have been a lot easier if I didn't have this sensibility. I mean, when you're dealing with an apparent population that has a very different sensibility, things can sometimes get tricky. So again, from this non-dual sensibility, no, we don't see what we want to see. There's just this happening the way it happens. I have no explanation for it whatsoever. All the storylines that I've ever offered in relation to this non-dual sensibility, they've been offered in order to examine the storyline, to essentially examine the storyline, and to discover the contradictions that lie within the storyline, not just for me, but for every human being that I know of. And in examining those contradictions, it simply points out the impossibility of those storylines to describe life in any true way. Now, from this non-dual sensibility, everyone, even if you have a non-dual sensibility, there's still going to be apparent storylines that arise. And everyone's apparent storyline is a legitimate expression of this totally unexplainable happening. It's quite fine for anyone to have any storyline. It's quite fine for apparent people to believe in their storylines. It's quite fine for apparent people to not believe in their storylines. Everything is the legitimate expression of whatever this is. It just is what it is. As U.G. Krishnamurti used to say, "Yeah, I've got as many opinions as everyone else, but they're just as ridiculous as all the as everyone else's opinions. And none of that can be explained. All right, moving on. The next person has written in saying, Daryl, please discuss racism from a non-dual perspective. Thank you for keeping the airspace open for discussions on this and other topics. Namaste. Racism. Okay, let's let's see what comes up here. Well, racism, what we call racism, that would again, from a non-dual sensibility, be one of the legitimate expressions of existence. It would be one of the natural expressions of nature or the universe. So on that, from that absolute non-dual sensibility, it's again just a totally unexplainable happening. It's not really something that we can identify as racism. However, within the world of form and within that storyline of racism, there are some interesting factors. I mean, it's quite obvious in observing the development of children that there is an essential need, an essential drive, and it seems to be somewhat related to a survival mechanism, that people are attracted to those that are similar to them. And they find anything that's different to be a bit threatening. And that seems to be some basic inclination within an apparent human being, within this world of apparent form. So we could say, even though none of those explanations are true, there is, you know, and even though form is ultimately not true, within the apparent world of form, you know, this, or let me put it this way, this unexplainable formless event, this formless happening, when it expresses itself in apparent form, or seems to express itself in apparent form, and within that world of apparent form, it seems that there is an inclination in each of us, in our early development, there is an easily observable inclination for us to move toward what is familiar and what is similar to us, to what we identify as me, us. You know, we have this sense of what we are, and we're attracted to that which is similar. And we find anything that is different to be somewhat of a threat. Now, there are considerations that this may be functional on a level of survival, so that, you know, just in the sheer consideration of survival, this tendency to gather together with the similar aids our survival. So, from the non-dual sensibility, the bottom line, what we call racism is just a totally unexplainable happening automatically. But within the world of stories, within the world of form, there is this consideration that racism, what we call racism, may have its roots in this inclination that each apparent person has to move to the familiar, move to the similar, and to on some level, to fear the different. So from that consideration, one might wonder whether what we call racism could ever really be stamped out, because it actually seems to be something rooted in our basic survival mechanisms. Now, this is just a comment on the opinions of what we might call the scientific community. There are lots of other apparent opinions on topics such as racism. And from a non-dual sensibility, these are all simply opinions that actually none of them really apply to what's going on here. So from this non-dual sensibility, I mean, if you're interested in a non-dual sensibility, I mean, at the consideration of that sensibility will ultimately have to bring you back each and every time in your consideration of existence, it will have to bring you back to a totally unexplainable happening, just a happening of this moment. And the sense that it has no particular form, that all of it is happening automatically, it's just is what it is in this moment, and that no description legitimately applies to this. So when I say there's just the happening of this moment, I'm not attempting to describe the fact that there is just the happening of this moment. What this is an attempt to point to the fact that if it's realized that there is no possible explanation for what's happening in this moment, for this, it still doesn't get rid of the basic feeling that there is something happening in this moment. So even if I don't say anything at all, even if I don't think anything at all, it doesn't leave me with the feeling that existence disappears. So ultimately, from this non-dual sensibility, you're just left saying, what is, is. It's just that there's no way of saying what that is. There's no way of saying even that there is an is. It's not so much leaving you with a possibility of saying anything about what's going on here. It's more that this sensibility consistently pushes forward the contradictions within stories. It pushes forward the fact that even our storyline itself ultimately has to declare, if it's examined, if the basics of our storyline are examined, and not just my storyline, if the basics of anybody's storyline are examined, there is so much contradiction within those storylines that they invalidate themselves in any kind of ultimate way, as any kind of ultimately true description of existence. They don't invalidate themselves as something useful on a day-to-day basis, but they invalidate themselves as any kind of absolute statement about existence. And so you're not left with any possibility of describing existence. However, even if you're not left with the possibility of describing existence, it doesn't feel as though existence disappears. So ultimately you end up having to say there's no way of saying anything at all. But then if I just stuck to that, we wouldn't have these monthly responses. And in these monthly responses, I'm simply, within the storyline, pointing out the futility of attempting to describe what's going on here. If anything is going on here. All right. A third person has written in saying, "Hi, I'm a 23-year-old guy from Finland. I have about 3 years of Zen practice in two different traditions, even though I'm not part of any Zen group or any other meditation group or spiritual tradition anymore. I was drawn to Zen because I was interested in so-called spiritual awakening and because of the urge to get some kind of personal experience about the matter. I decided to go on a 7-day Zen retreat last December. Somewhere in the middle of the retreat, I had this moment of realization when the question suddenly dissolved." I guess he was working with a koan, a question that can't really be answered conceptually. So he said, "I had this moment of realization when the question suddenly dissolved, disappearing into thin air, leaving only this. In that moment, and for a time after this experience, I really thought I had solved this matter once and for all. But the problem is this. After some time, the subtle sense of seeking or dissatisfaction came back, and I felt I was back to square one. And even though I was theoretically convinced that there's nothing to achieve, I didn't really experience life in this non-dual way anymore. This led me to continue my investigations on this apparent non-dual subject until I came across first Tony Parsons' book, All There Is, and after that your book, Dismantling the Fantasy. The basic message expressed in these two books really struck me, that in fact that there is no separate individual with a free will who could get enlightened. Therefore, the whole idea that there is someone who could achieve some state of awakening or fall out from it started to feel pretty absurd, and both paradoxically and ironically, I started to have little glimpses of oneness again. But again, even though I theoretically understood that there's no me who could choose or gain anything, and even though I started to have these little moments of aha again, there's still this subtle sense of dissatisfaction and a process of seeking going on. And I think that as far as this seeking or futile attempt to explain existence is going on, there's going to be some dissatisfaction. But I cannot force this process to stop because it seems to continue functioning by itself, whether I want it or not. So my question is this. Do you think there's anything I could even apparently do to dissolve this process of seeking or to somehow surrender? Intellectually, of course, I know there's probably no me who could do anything about this. But is there anything that one could even apparently do to really realize this? For example, you think there is some connection between the different forms of meditation or just sitting or shikantaza in Zen tradition and awakening. Is this apparent awakening something that more often happens to people who have had some experience of meditation, or is it something that can just as likely happen to someone who's never had any interest in any spiritual practice? You write that phrases such as there is no self and there is only God are very simple descriptions of your ordinary everyday life. Understanding these statements does not require blind belief or new learning or 30 years to achieve. Still, for me, it seems that most people who are communicating this awakening are also people who often have some kind of spiritual background or meditation career. Can this really be a coincidence? For example, when I had, or at least I think I had, my first really powerful glimpse of so-called awakening, it happened in an intensive meditation retreat. I don't think that this is a coincidence, but at the same time, I also feel that the idea that I should somehow continue practicing to maintain or deepen this realization feels kind of dualistic and in contradiction with the apparent fact that there is no separate individual with a free will and all there is this. Actually, this is one of the biggest reasons why I left Zen tradition. So if you had time to read this long and scrappy email of mine, and if you could answer my questions in your next talk, I would really appreciate it. I read all of that because that's nicely expressed, but within this, there really is only one real question, and he's asking if I think there is a particular thing that he could even apparently do to reach realization more quickly or more deeply. And I guess as part of that, he's wondering if I feel that meditation really aids the awakening process. Can it simply be a coincidence that many people seem to have their awakening in a meditation situation? I don't feel it's a coincidence that many people have their so-called awakening in a meditation situation. However, I mean, this is an expression of existence itself. Existence itself expresses itself this way. However, it also expresses other apparent people as having this realization without any meditation. So there are a number of ways we can consider this. If we really start to feel that meditation is a requirement for realization, then we have to really wonder what was going on with people like Ramana Maharshi, who, when at the age of 16, he just felt like he was dying and was curious about that situation. So he thought, well, let me just lie down here and just see what this process feels like. And in that, his whole sense of being separate from existence slipped away. All the belief in his storylines slipped away, and it became obvious that there was only a great mysterious happening. Now, he referred to that totally unexplainable happening in a number of different ways. He sometimes called it pure consciousness. He sometimes called it awareness with a capital A, and he sometimes just called it existence. Or you have to wonder about individuals like Albert Einstein, who at the age of 17 read Schopenhauer. And he read, basically, when he read Schopenhauer's line about how you can do what you want to do, but you can't create your wants, in that moment, Einstein realized that he was an expression of existence itself, that he didn't create his own wants. So he basically didn't create his motivation to move through life in any particular way. And it was also obvious that he didn't create his body or his mind. So if he didn't create his body or his mind, and he didn't create his basic motivation in life, what it was that moved him through life, then obviously he had to be totally an expression of existence. We also have to look at the fact that if meditation is this great instrument for bringing people to awakening, I would ask anybody in any meditation group or anybody who has a great deal of meditation experience, like out of the thousands of people that are maybe meditating in your own particular tradition, or out of the hundreds of thousands of people that have been meditating through the centuries, how many people are actually considered to be fully enlightened? They're pretty few and far between. So in a consideration of this, perhaps more specifically, we have to consider what this person is meaning by meditation. So the word meditation is just a blanket term. And there are thousands of different techniques that fall under this blanket term meditation. So the sense I get from this person's question is they're not talking about meditation. They're not asking me if meditation aids awakening. They're asking me if just sitting aids in awakening. Or I can probably say that what he means by just sitting is probably what other people might call mindfulness practice or simple, bare awareness, bare observation of the moment. Does that aid in awakening? And all I can say to that is that it seems like for some people, that sitting in meditation or in that just sitting or in that bare awareness, in the simple acknowledgement of the happening of this moment, this non-dual sensibility may arise. However, it's also the case that some apparent person can just sit for the rest of their lives and they will never have a non-dual sensibility. It's also the case that somebody walking down the street can have this non-dual sensibility arise without even being interested in spirituality or without even knowing that this is going to be the case. There are situations where people are going through extreme trauma, and at the end of that trauma, they have a non-dual sensibility. It's also the case that somebody can go through 30 years of meditation practice and then give it up totally and be lying in bed reading a book. And the book is just making a comment that, a general comment, it's not even a very clear comment, it's just making an entire book is making a general comment, a vague and general comment that if we examine our life, we don't have any example that supports the notion that we're directing our lives. We don't have any experience of that. And in simply reading that general comment, it becomes, all of a sudden, there's this non-dual sensibility. It becomes incredibly obvious that everything I am is an expression of nature, the universe, the unformed ocean of existence, whatever you want to call it. There's just this big event doing what it does, and no one exists as anything separate from that expression. It's also the case from this non-dual sensibility. For those who have expressed a non-dual sensibility, they will ultimately declare that they didn't do anything in their life, that life simply moved in the way it moved, that they would have to, from their non-dual sensibility, if it really is what is known as a non-dual sensibility, what would be classically known as a non-dual sensibility, it would be a simple acknowledgement that the sense of life is that it is a totally unexplainable eventing. And that eventing simply occurs on its own. So it wasn't even the case that there was somebody interested in enlightenment, pursuing enlightenment, and eventually coming to enlightenment. From a non-dual sensibility, it's that there is just simply always a totally unexplainable happening. So from all of these considerations, I can't really say that meditation is pertinent to awakening. However, in these considerations, if it's not really meditation that occurs just before awakening, what seems to occur in this process of awakening is a simple acknowledgement of how life is actually presenting itself. And here we come to a very interesting, what might be called a very interesting observation about this process of meditators and enlightenment. Most meditators are not interested in acknowledge, most what we would call meditators are not interested in acknowledging life in the way that it's actually presenting itself, or the way that it is generally presenting itself to each of us, the way that we can just generally acknowledge how it's presenting itself. Most meditators are not interested in that. Most meditators are trying to get enlightened, and they have a preconceived notion of what enlightenment is. So what they're trying to do is produce a state of mind in which they feel totally blissful, a state of mind in which they don't have any sense of separation from the rest of existence, a state of mind that is peaceful, constantly peaceful, and without a sense of separate ego. So, since most meditators are interested in producing that state of mind because that's what they think enlightenment is, they will not acknowledge life as it actually is. Because life does not express itself as one particular state of mind. Life has no particular form. Life is a totally mysterious event, or better, more succinctly, what is does not exhibit any particular form. It exhibits apparent forms, but in anyone's detailed consideration of these forms, it becomes obvious, or one has to ultimately declare that these forms are changing. Whether they're changing apparently slowly or apparently quickly doesn't really matter. For everyone, they're changing. Now that's a very direct acknowledgement of what our general so-called experience is. However, meditators don't like that. Meditators want to produce a particular state of mind that feels good, that feels pleasant, and that's what they want. They don't want what life actually is. They want what they think it should be, or what they hope it should be, or what they hope it will be. A constant state of unseparated bliss. And so they go on their retreats, and they have these passing mind states which arise for some in these retreat situations, passing mind states that are extremely pleasant, that have a very strong sense that all of existence is undivided. This very strong feeling that existence itself, and that includes us, is this undivided ocean moving and shifting and dancing. And that's incredibly wonderful. Those are incredibly wonderful passing appearances, but that's not how life expresses itself. Life expresses itself in moments in that way. What life is a totally unexplainable, unformed or formless happening, moving and shifting and dancing on its own. That's the acknowledgement. Now, meditators don't want that in general. However, everyone, every apparent person that has had this supposed awakening, what you might call awakening, that's what they've had to acknowledge. That existence is an event that will present itself in whatever way it presents itself, and we ultimately do not have any say in that, because we don't exist as anything apart from the presentation. So, do I feel there is something you can apparently do to aid this awakening? Yes. You can apparently acknowledge that no matter how much you want life to be bliss-filled all the time, you can't have that. And you can apparently acknowledge that no matter how much you want to explain whatever this is in this moment, you can't ultimately do that. And no matter how much you might want to have control, no matter how much you might want to feel that you're in charge, that you're creating yourself, Actually, you can apparently simply acknowledge that you don't create yourself. And no matter how much you want to have a technique or a system for controlling existence, for ultimately producing that world of perfection that you want, you can apparently just acknowledge that you can't have that. And if you apparently acknowledge all of this, what you're left with is just this happening of this moment, presenting whatever it presents. And that's what every awakened being, every so-called awakened being, apparently acknowledged. Now, within the world of stories, it arose in a different way in every situation. And actually, the details of that acknowledgement are different for each and every apparent person. But the general acknowledgement is that there's no way of explaining what's happening in this moment, and no one is making it happen. And that includes everything that we are. Nobody's making it happen. It's just happening. This has nothing to do with any particular state of mind. This has nothing to do with life being pleasant all the time. There isn't any awakened being that had life pleasant all the time. There isn't any awakened being that had a constant state of this unformed euphoric bliss. I mean, even like Ramana Maharshi would read the newspaper in the afternoon and listen to the radio, and he would say he wasn't in any kind of concentrated state all the time. He said if he wanted concentration, he would walk up Mount Arunachala, and by the time he got to the top, it was likely that he would be in a very concentrated state. But that concentrated euphoric bliss wasn't there all the time. The guy died of cancer, a very painful cancer. The guy swept the floor. He never even had his own private room. Like, he swept the floor in the courtyard where he slept. He was constantly surrounded by people jabbering all kinds of questions. This wasn't some kind of constant euphoria. Now, when this person initially sent his question in, I responded in a very brief note, saying that in my experience, it wasn't that meditation was the essential factor in awakening. Basically, for some people, that seems to be part of their awakening process, and for others, it isn't. But it's not the essential factor in all cases. And I can't even make the statement that people who meditate are more likely to become awakened, because actually in my experience, I mean, I spent 9 years in mindfulness centers, and I spent 6 years as a meditation monk, and I never found more people in those organizations having this non-dual sensibility than those outside of these organizations. And actually, I won't say who it was, but I asked a very, very famous meditation monk, a world-famous meditation monk, whether it was his experience that monastic life and the life of a meditation monk produced awakening more than it occurred in the general public. And he said, no, that wasn't his experience. Now, maybe it's somebody else's experience. I don't know. However, in any event, I responded briefly to this person saying that I didn't find that meditation was necessarily the essential factor in this so-called awakening. And he wrote back saying, thanks for your brief answer. I'm looking forward to hearing the next monthly response. It's very interesting that you think that no more meditators come to this non-dual realization than non-meditators. Could it be that the whole idea or fantasy of me walking a spiritual path towards enlightenment could be the reason that apparently keeps many meditators from realizing this non-dual sensibility? I'm just wondering. So I guess your answer is that I can't do anything to realize anything because the whole idea that there's a separate me who could do anything about anything is a fantasy, since all there is just this mysterious event happening itself. Still, in your talk, Overview of Awakening, you say something like this, if I remember correctly. When you just sit and do nothing, it becomes obvious that everything is just happening by itself. So do you think that sitting and doing nothing is something different than meditation, or doesn't even this sitting and doing nothing have any apparent connection with awakening? It feels that sometimes I do relate to this non-dual sensibility and sometimes not, even though I intellectually understand that all there is just this unexplainable mysterious happening by itself. What my actual experience seems to be is that sometimes it feels like everything is just flowing by itself smoothly, but sometimes I can also be very caught up in my fantasies and futile attempts trying to desperately explain this event, which probably is ultimately unexplainable. But ultimately, it probably doesn't matter so much, since it's all the same happening. And I would like to just give a big resounding yes to this statement. But he has a few points here, so let's look at these. Could it be that the whole idea or fantasy of me walking a spiritual path towards enlightenment could be the reason that keeps many meditators from realizing this non-dual sensibility? Well, yes. If an apparent person is totally wrapped up in the idea that he or she is a particular person slowly making his way or her way towards some ultimate understanding of life or some ultimate state called enlightenment, and they think that that enlightenment state is about some kind of ongoing bliss, yes, they're not acknowledging what needs to be acknowledged in this so-called awakening. In this non-dual sensibility, you're not acknowledging that you're a person walking a spiritual path towards some unending bliss. This non-dual sensibility is simply acknowledging that there's just the happening of this moment, whatever, you know, there's no way of saying anything about it, really. There's just this doing what it does. And we don't get to say what it's going to do, because whatever we seem to be is also the expression of this happening, whatever this is. That none of the explanations apply to it. It's just this doing what it does. And he says that my answer to his questions would have to be that he can't do anything to realize anything, because the whole idea that there's a separate me who could do anything about anything is a fantasy. And yes, ultimately, that would have to be my statement, that the whole notion that anybody brings themselves to awakening is just as much a fantasy as anything else. Even the story of awakening is a fantasy. There's just a totally unexplainable happening. There's just this happening, what we might call the happening of this moment. I mean, I don't even know if you can call it a happening, but I don't have any other words. Words are limited. They just point. Like, there's this doing what it does. It's never a matter of people that are ignorant or people that are awakening or people that were on a spiritual journey. I mean, these apparent stories still come and go, but that's a totally unexplainable happening. And from this, from what would be known as a classically as a non-dual sensibility, that's what gets acknowledged. Just this doing what it does. There isn't any person causing it. There isn't any way to explain it. It's just this doing what it does. Now, He points out that I will sometimes say that when you just sit and do nothing, it may become obvious that everything is just happening. So he asks whether I think that sitting and doing nothing is something different from meditation. And yes, because sitting and doing nothing is a very specific description. Meditation is a blanket statement that covers about 1,001 different things. So instead of using these vague terms like meditation, let's, you know, if we're interested, we can perhaps consider that in this case, we're talking about sitting and making no effort. I don't really say sitting and doing nothing. I more specifically say, if you sit and make no effort to do anything, it may become obvious that everything is just happening on its own. Because how would you discover if everything is happening on its own? In order to discover that, it would most obviously be the case if you sat down and made no effort, made no conscious effort to do anything. There may be the discovery that life doesn't stop, your process doesn't stop, and everything goes on presenting itself on its own. Now, even if I asked everyone in the world to sit down and make no effort, for some, it would become, there would be the sense that everything was just this magical event presenting itself. And for others, that would not be of any interest whatsoever. They would never focus on that. And even if they did focus on it, it wouldn't be of any real interest to them because life doesn't express them as having a non-dual sensibility. They're more interested in the storyline. And in fact, in my gatherings over the years, I've had many people come through and they say, yes, I can see that if I sit down and I make no conscious effort, everything just happens on its own. Everything's just happening on its own. But I'm more interested in the storyline. I want my storyline. And that's perfectly fine. That's also a legitimate expression of existence. Now, it's in this last statement of this person that we come more to the acknowledgement required. We come more to the acknowledgement of life as it actually is to all of us. He says, it feels that sometimes I relate to this non-dual sensibility and sometimes not. Even though I intellectually understand that all there is just this unexplainable, mysterious happening by itself, what my actual experience seems to be is that sometimes I feel like everything is just flowing by itself smoothly, but sometimes I can also be very caught in my fantasies and futile attempts trying to desperately explain this event, which probably is ultimately unexplainable. And then he says, but ultimately, this probably doesn't matter, since it's all the same happening. That's the acknowledgement. That's the awakened acknowledgement. It doesn't really matter what it presents. It's just this happening, doing what it does. Now, whether or not you're interested in that fact, I mean, we can call it a fact, because if everyone sits down and makes no conscious effort to do anything, everything that life is continues to present itself. It doesn't disappear. So, whether or not there's any real interest in that acknowledgement, nobody can do anything about. Either you're interested or you're not interested. Either you're apparently interested or you're not interested. And if you are apparently interested, this is the frustrating thing that gets acknowledged, that it doesn't really matter what we want. It doesn't really matter how it presents itself. It is just a totally unexplainable happening presenting itself. If you think the Buddha wanted to be nailed, or if you think the Buddha wanted to be having excruciating back pain, if you think the Buddha wanted to live through famine, if you think the Buddha was having a great time when his two closest students died, if you think that the Buddha wanted to die of food poisoning and having weeks and weeks of vomiting and diarrhea, I can't go along with that. I don't think that was a bliss-filled experience. If you think Christ wanted to be tortured and nailed to a cross, I don't go along with that. I don't feel that that was a bliss-filled experience of the unformed ocean of existence. I think in both their cases, what they had to acknowledge was it didn't really matter what they wanted. Life was going to present whatever it presented. All right, this has run on. It's about an hour and 15 minutes already, so I'm going to end this portion of the response here. There can be too much of this sort of thing, both in my expressing it and listening to it. So we'll end it here. And if and when you want to go on with part two, you can click on part two.